field theory for quantum gravity from shape dynamics. Tim?
Thank you. This talk continues to report on results in shape dynamics, and some of you will remember that I gave a talk in this series about half a year ago on shape dynamics. So let's please go to slide number 2. I will give a quick introduction and state the main result of this talk. And then I will go into the nuts and bolts of the construction of shape dynamics, and then do something new with that, namely construct a gravity action that has in a particular sense incorporates both the symmetries of general relativity in the ADM formulation and of shape dynamics. And then we call this action W general relativity, and then I will investigate that a little bit, and I will talk about the immediate consequences for that come from this scenario. So let's please go to slide number 3. The motivation for many of us, for most people in this seminar, is that general relativity is not renormalizable. So this hints to that our usual field theory understanding of gravity, that there is something wrong with that. We cannot take a continuum limit in the usual sense. And that is the reason why people do loop quantum gravity, or the research programs that developed out of the loop quantum gravity framework, why other people do string theory and so on. The problem from the statistical mechanics point of view is really that we don't have the right universality class for gravity. This means that we don't understand how to connect a continuum limit of a gravity theory, of a metric theory, with a theory that in the infrared becomes the Einstein-Hilbert action and still stays predictive in the UV limit. For taking these, for understanding universality classes, it's often very important to have symmetries at one point. And the reason for that is that the renormalization group flow stays on a surface that may evolve, but that's a technical detail, that is defined by the symmetries. The symmetries are in particular in a path integral formulation encoded in BRST invariants of the path integral action. And that implies, this BRST invariance implies, together with invariance of the path integral measure, Slavnov Taylor identities for the effective action. And in this sense, because there are additional constraints on the form of the effective action, in this sense is where symmetries help understand new universality classes, because they put new additional constraints on the effective action. So the possibility that I want to highlight in this talk is that there may be a hidden symmetry in the gravity action. And the reason why that might be interesting is because this symmetry may be present, maybe part of your fundamental definition of a gravity theory, and then you do explicit calculations, for example, in the renormalization group framework, and if you're not adapted to that symmetry, if you're not searching compatible with that symmetry, you may not find the universality class that comes along with that, simply because your search is poorly adapted to that. So let's go to slide number 4, and I want to state the main message of this talk, and this is that there is a particular action for gravity, which we call doubly general relativity, and it's a gauge fixed action for ADM, but this particular version of the ADM action has a hidden BST invariance that is due to shape dynamics, that is exactly implementing the symmetries of shape dynamics. So let's go to slide number 5. Now I will go quickly over the background, over the construction of shape dynamics and symmetry trading, what is important for that. So let's go to slide number 6. And in this picture here, let's focus on the center. What is depicted there is a phase space and two constraint surfaces in this phase space, the red and the blue surface. And these are not just arbitrary constraint surfaces, these are first class constraint surfaces. This is, they are foliated by gauge orbits, and this is what is indicated by this red and blue line. They are indicating that they are gauge orbits in the surface. And what that means for observables is that observables are supposed to be gauge invariant, so they are supposed to be constant along a gauge orbit. So they are functions on the constraint surface that are constant along the gauge orbit. So they're completely determined by picking out one single point out of each gauge orbit. So now if you look at this purple line that I drew in these three diagrams in the middle, this is the intersection of the two constraint surfaces, but it's also a gauge fixing for gauge theory A, the red theory on the right-hand side, and gauge theory B, the blue theory on the left-hand side. So the message of that is that all the physics that you can get can be equivalently described either through gauge theory A or through gauge theory B. And you can explicitly see that, how that comes about, by doing a further gauge fixing of gauge theory A, basically imposing the constraints of gauge theory B at gauge fixing conditions, and vice versa, imposing the constraints of gauge theory A as gauge fixing conditions on gauge theory B. And you get dictionary theory on a reduced phase space. You have to work out a Dirac bracket, but then you see that the two theories coincide. How this is actually done is through a particularly useful mechanism to get this done is through a linking theory that lives on an extended phase space. This is on the top line. And if the constraints of, if the first class constraints of this linking theory satisfies certain structural conditions, then you can perform the phase space reduction, basically remove the extension of phase space, and precisely construct these gauge theory A and gauge theory B that describe the same physics. So that is a technical tool that will be that was very important for our understanding. So let's go to the next slide, number 7, and let's apply this to gravity. So we go to the ADM phase space, and so now I have two constraint surfaces on ADM phase space. So one is ADM gravity, so you have the spatial diffeomorphism that you understand very well, and you have the scalar constraint, which take a rather complicated form. But their physical interpretation is that local time reparametrization. So they generate on shell generators of refoliations. And this system is well understood and well interpreted, and in applying this mechanism that I described on the previous slide, we can construct a theory that we call shape dynamics. And basically, what we do is we trade all of the scalar constraints of general relativity, except for one, for spatial conformal constraints that do not change the total spatial volume. This is in the case where you have a compact Cauchy surface without boundary conditions, which is the simplest case. Other cases are possible, but it's more complicated to describe them. And then the leftover scalar constraint then becomes a generator of dynamics, and it takes the form of basically saying that the volume of the total three volume of the hypersurface has to be compatible with the initial value problem of ADM gravity. So it's saying the shape degrees of freedom and your time dictate your particular volume for the hypersurface. So we have traded this system, the ADM system, with refoliation invariance for a system that has local spatial conformal invariance, and both systems have spatial diffeomorphism invariance. So let's go to the next slide and make a brief interlude on the relation of Dirac observables, because that was what I just explained, where physics really happens. And what we saw here is you have two intersecting constraint surfaces, and in local and they gauge fix one another. So in local coordinates in phase space, so the Q's and P's here are local coordinates on my phase space that I choose, I can write the constraints of one theory as some operator M acting on Q's, and the constraints of the other theory, the sigmas, as some operator N times P minus P naught, where P naught is a function of all the other P's and Q's that are not alpha or beta. And then you see that this constraint surface that is described in with these variables is equivalently described through two completely abelian sets. One is just the Q alpha says zero, and the other one is that the P beta takes particular values, P beta naught. So now you look at the Hamilton vector fields that are generated by these sets of constraints, and you see, oh, the Hamilton vector fields, they commute now with one another. So they're Frobenius integral. And this means that for every initial condition that you have on reduced phase space, you can find a finite region around the point on this reduced phase space, where you have a phase space function that commutes with both these sets of abelian variables. And this gives you a preferred set of representatives for observables that are strong Dirac observables for both theories. And then you can easily identify the two, because you can just say, okay, if I take an observable, I choose this particular representative that has these special properties from theory A and do the same in theory B, and I identify the two if they coincide, if they strongly coincide. This is different from weak coinciding, what I described before. Now, this abelianization that I needed for that spoils locality in field theory, and this is a structural argument, but it's not a very practical argument. However, even in the non-abelian case, there is still a dictionary between the observables, and that comes through the linking theory that I described in the beginning. Basically, you have the linking theory, you work out the observables there, choose particular representatives, and do the two phase space reductions, and then you get observables of theory A and theory B, and you get precisely a one-to-one relation between the two. So now I want to switch gears, and I want to introduce the BRST formalism, because that's what we will do in subsequently to the system. And I will just give you a quick and dirty introduction that highlights the essential features that I need for later. So I will assume that I have abelian constraints, so chi alphas, and then I can easily construct a BRS generator. This is, I extend my phase space to include ghost, eta alpha, one eta for each first class constraint, and ghost momentum, this is a capital P alpha, and then the BRS generator is eta alpha chi alpha sum over alpha, of course. This is now an odd faceless function. So your child, in our case, they're bosonic constraints, and the ghosts always have the opposite statistics, so in our case, they're fermionic ghosts. And this is why the condition that I wrote right next to it, that omega Poisson commutes with itself, is non-trivial, because now the Poisson bracket is even in omega, because omega is an odd function. But that is a nice thing, because now you can define, now you have a graded differential algebra that defines a resolution of the observable algebra. This differential is just taking the Poisson bracket with the BIS generator. It's graded by the ghost number, so you just count each ghost as ghost number plus one, each ghost momentum as ghost number minus one. And then it is, in the abelian case, you can straightforwardly see how the observables are recovered as the cohomology of this differential at ghost number zero, so it's the resolution of the observable algebra. And for that, we look, in the abelian case, you always have a sufficient number, a complete set of strong observables. But for strong observables, they automatically commute with the BIS generator. So that is fine, so they're in the kernel. And then the equivalence that you have is you can add an arbitrary exact term, provided the whole thing is of ghost number zero again. For that, I use a gauge fixing function psi, that has ghost number minus one, and just add this exact term, this omega Poisson bracket with psi. And now you see that the strong observable plus a phase space dependent linear combination of the constraints, that's a generic weak observable in the abelian case. So we have how calculating the cohomology is precisely finding the observables of a theory. And the important point why this formalism is advantageous is because you always have strong equations. Even for weak observables, you have a strong equation that detects this observable on extended phase space, of course. And now we want to also have dynamics, so we look at a gauge fixed Hamiltonian. It turns out that you can always construct the Hamiltonian H naught that commutes, that Poisson commutes with the omega, and whose ghost free part is exactly the original Hamiltonian of the system. And then the gauge fixed Hamiltonian is just adding to this H naught a Poisson bracket omega with the gauge fixing function psi. So now let me just explain. I said in general we have non-abelian constraints, and in field theories we really want to retain these non-abelian constraints because they are usually the only description that is local. And in the BIS formalism, there is a nice thing that you can actually go from the abelian constraints to non-abelian constraints by performing a canonical transformation on extended phase space. And because it's a canonical transformation, all the arguments that I used above, they still hold. You just have to, because it's all just based on Poisson brackets, so all the relations are morphism, so a canonical transformation is the morphism of the Poisson structure. So everything holds, but I get a modified BIS operator that has now higher order ghost terms, but still it's nilpotent, and its cohomology at ghost number zero still detects observables. So let's go to the next slide. Now I will use this to construct what I will call is to construct a special action that I will call doubly general relativity. So let's go to slide number 11. What we had to construct shape dynamics, or to perform symmetry trading in general, was that we had two first-class constraint surfaces, the original system and the equivalent gauge system, and these two surfaces gauge fix one another. And now, something that I did not explain in the when I introduced the BRST formalism, but that is important to notice, is that this omega, that the fact that omega is nilpotent, comes from the fact that you have a first-class constraint system. This is the reason why you can construct omega to be nilpotent. But now, because the gauge fixing functions, there is also a first-class system there. You can also choose a psi. You can find a psi that is first-class. Actually, there is a subtlety there that we will see later. But essentially, you can find a gauge fixing function that is nilpotent by itself. And so if you have a non-shell Hamiltonian, H0, that Poisson commutes both with omega and psi, then the gauge fixed Hamiltonian will be annihilated by both taking the Poisson bracket with omega and taking the Poisson bracket with psi, because omega and psi are nilpotent. And this is what we call symmetry doubling now, which is not anti-BRST invariant. The relation to that is quite non-trivial. And this is that the canonical action that you just write down the symplectic potential with the original phase space and the BRS extension minus the gauge fixed Hamiltonian, that this is invariant under two BRST transformations, obviously always up to a boundary term and time. This is what you have when you do a canonical transformation. You neglect this boundary term and time. So let's apply this to general relativity. We go to slide number 12. And for this, we will extend the construction of shape dynamics a little bit. Because for what I told you a couple of slides ago, in shape dynamics, we did not trade all the scalar constraints of ADM for conformal constraints, but we basically restricted the conformal transformations to be such that they preserve the total free volume. Now we lift this restriction here because we want a complete gauge fixing, and so we have a fixed mean curvature, a fixed trace of height in this extended phase space. And for aesthetic reasons, we also gauge fix the diffeomorphisms. It's actually for the classical argument that we want to make, it's not important. What is important is that this gauge fixing condition, which is a form of harmonic gauge where we project onto the harmonic gauge just imposed on the conformal metric, that this is first class with respect to the fixed CNC condition. And you can explicitly calculate the Poisson brackets with these two, and you see that the Qs, the generators of conformal transformations, they commute with one another. The Fs, they commute with one another because they're just Gs, just metrics appearing, no metric momenta in them. And the Qs and the Fs, their Poisson bracket reproduces an F. Now this system has a very tentative interpretation as a local conformal system. This is because the Qs you can interpret as dilatations over each point. They rescale the metric. And the Fs over each point have the same Lie algebra with the Qs and amongst each other as the special conformal transformations have in three dimensions. This cube. I think this is a fluke. This is not the proof that this is, but it's an intuitive interpretation of the system. So now we can use this system to gauge fix ADM. And what we find is that the gauge fixing operator, so the Poisson bracket of this gauge fixing conditions with the ADM constraint, is elliptic and is elliptic everywhere on phase space, and it is invertible in a particular region in phase space. You can show that it's invertible there, and outside that region there is a meager subset where this operator will have a finite dimensional kernel. However, for the present construction, that is not an obstruction. So let's go to slide number 13. So what I told you is the strategy is to have a gauge fixed action that has two Beer's invariances, and we make use that this extended version of shape dynamics is itself a first class system. So on the one side, you can just look at the ADM action, and this is known, the Beer's charge is well known in the literature. It's the first line. The second thing is we can now construct the Beer's charge for this extended shape dynamic system, but we switch the roles of ghost and ghost momenta in this construction because we essentially want, that doesn't change anything about the nilpotency of this operator, but what it does change is that this then essentially does that this omega extended shape dynamics has ghost number minus one, whereas the omega of ADM has ghost number plus one. So the Poisson bracket has ghost number zero. So now we can construct a gauge fixed action, a gauge fixed gravity action, a gauge fixed ADM action actually, by just putting in this symplectic potential, so pi AB, G dot AB, plus the symplectic potential of the ghost sector, and then we have this Poisson bracket between ADM and between omega ADM and omega extended shape dynamics because the on-shell Hamiltonian of ADM vanishes. So this is invariant under the usual ADM BST transformation, but also invariant under a hidden BST invariant, and this is the one that is generated by taking Poisson brackets with omega ESD. And I wrote this transformation down explicitly in the box underneath, where I abstained from writing down the pi abs. The reason I didn't write that down is because the Fs have a complicated structure, as you saw on the previous slide, and they impose a complicated, their Poisson bracket with the pi makes this expression lengthy. It makes it about one line in this type setting. So this is what we call this action, this particular action that has these two invariances. It's what we call doubly general relativity because in a certain sense it incorporates both the ADM symmetries and the shape dynamic symmetries in the same action. So let's go to the next slide, number 14, and let's look at this Hamiltonian that we get for this theory. And when you look at the ghost-free part, you see that it's a scalar constraint smeared with a particular phase space function and the diffeomorphism smeared with a particular phase space function. So you see in particular that this is neither the frozen time Hamiltonian, this H equals zero, nor is it the CMC Hamiltonian where the lapse would be the solution to the lapse fixing equation of the CMC gauge. But and this is what I said before, there is a subtlety between when I said that the gauge, that I can use the gauge fixing psi here, because now I'm using a gauge fixing as the value of the Lagrange multiplier, essentially. So this doubly general relativity Hamiltonian is a generator of true dynamics whenever lambda plus the mean of trace pi is bigger than zero. So this is why we call it, why we think that it's a good Hamiltonian, because the ghost free part really contains a generator of true dynamics. And it is completely local. So now I want to again switch gears and talk about effective field theory, because one of the things is now we have something that is local, and we have something that we have an action that is local, and we have an action that incorporates two different symmetries. And that could be, and those are usually things that you put into the definition of a theory. And I want to just go quickly over standard effective field theory reasoning to show you that the symmetry depthing goes through this entire reasoning. So let's go to slide number 16.
Tim?
Yes?
Yeah, just a quick question. The Hamiltonian is a generator of true dynamics when that condition is satisfied at the bottom of your slide, but that's when Q is not equal to zero, so isn't that off the constraint surface?
That is true when you view it from the side of shape dynamics. Actually, there is a way to understand this in terms of observables, because what I have not been talking about in this talk, and what I also will abstain from in this talk is that when you actually calculate predictions with this theory, you have to calculate predictions for BAS observables. And BAS observables for ADM are again these timeless functions. BAS observables for shape dynamics are again these scale invariant functions. So there is a difference in interpretation of the things that you calculate with this dynamics. But it's not, it's the same thing if you put in, if you put in a gauge fixing condition and you say this gauge fixing condition has to hold, then a Lagrange multiplier has to satisfy a particular has to be at a particular value, then you may say that that is off the constraint surface as well.
Okay.
So let's go to slide number 16. So I will briefly talk about the renormalization group and effective field theory. And the renormalization group is used in the asymptotic safety program in quantum gravity extensively. And what it is essentially it's an interpolation of, it's constructing an interpolation of effective actions between a local bare action or bare action in the UV with an effective action, which is the standard effective action of your quantum field theory, the generator of one particle irreducible Green's functions in the infrared. And it's this one parameter family of gamma k, and that is the functional of a certain field constant, and you can put certain constraints on that. And in the asymptotic safety program, people look for a UV fixed point that has a few relevant directions. So you can take the, in this case, then you would be able to take the continuum limit end of this theory, you could remove the regulator. And if there are just a few relevant directions, then you have a predictive theory, because we just have to make a few measurements in the infrared, and then you have fixed all the three parameters of the theory. However, I will not, for the arguments that follow, I will not follow this reasoning, which is way too hard. I will use a different reasoning, which is universality. This is basically the renormalization group washes out all the detail about the initial reaction, and all that becomes important in the infrared is in the vicinity of which, so all the detail about the reaction is lambda is forgotten, and only the attractor that it was closest to and that it is attracted to by renormalization group flow is important for the infrared, for the physics that you see in the infrared. So this in terms of one parameter flow, it says that the critical manifold associated with an attractor, most likely in most cases a fixed point, is infrared attractive. And so you will end up very close to this critical surface no matter where you start. So also for first investigation, you can make some approximations. We will not talk about fixed points, but because they are hard to find except for the Gaussian fixed point. But instead, we will just use structural constraints that you can consistently impose on the effective action, and these are the symmetries. And also, if you're in a weak coupling regime, then the renormalization group relevance, so those terms that can appear at low energies, they are given by dimensional analysis. And it's just the usual statement that in a weakly coupled theory, you just have low dimensional operators in your effective action. So this is where the renormalization group has two uses. One is what is used in the asymptotic safety program to find the fundamental theory. But for us, it will just be a particular reasoning in this talk to impose structural constraints on the quantum field theory, and then still find in the classical limit find that these constraints translate into constraints of the effective action in some semi-classical approximation. So let's go to the next slide, number 17. So now we assume that the definition of a gravity theory includes this symmetry doubling. That it includes that the bare action of gravity, if it exists, has these two BAS invariances. And then you can derive you assume that the path integral measure is invariant under BAS transformations, and then you get two sets of Slavnov-Taylor identities, with one for each of the BAS transformations, and they pose structural constraints on your effective action. Now, the problem in the formulation that we are using now is that the BAS variations of our elementary variables of g and pi and the ghosts, that they are nonlinear in the field. So these expectation values, so this triangle SADM phi a, for example, in triangle brackets, this expectation value, is a very complicated expression when you try to express it in terms of the effective action, gamma, because you have to perform the Deschamps transform and for this correlator. So this makes it practically not very useful, yet this constraint is there on the effective action. And also, these variations are nonlinear, obstructs the usual use of Singer-Stein equations, which are linear in the fields. And you again get two. I will not go into detail why you get them, but it's straightforward if you follow text if you follow the textbook analysis. And you get, but the thing is, you cannot, because you don't, basically because you don't have an anchor, something, some constraints on the effective action that are there, they still give you just some very loose conditions, some very loose structural constraints. But in the semi-classical approximation in the infrared, where you can replace this the expectation value with the field value, with the semi-classical field value, plus of course orders of H bar corrections, then you see, okay, these two constraints just turn into the usual structural constraints that the effective action is invariant under these two variations. So this means that if we assume that the fundamental theory has these two invariances, and it's reasonable that once you've found them, it's reasonable to put these structural constraints on the more fundamental theory, then you should be revising the definition of your gravity theory, because in a semi-classical regime, gravity should be a local action, a local action functional of your field current, so of the metric momentum and the ghost sector of ADM at ghost number zero. And it should be invariant under these two sets of BIS transformations. So this action should have two invariances. So now let me talk about some further directions. And these are really just the first baby steps into these things. They're not at all worked out in detail, but there are immediate questions that you would have. So let's go to slide number 19. One thing is what I just argued was that if you put these structural requirements on the quantum theory, then you have a construction principle for classical gravity, because effective field theory, as I just argued, gives you revised theory space with a theory space that has these two invariances, and then just doing dimensional analysis, this thing at low energies in a weakly coupled regime, it just has low dimensional operators left, then that gives you a construction principle for a classical action, and that is there is a class of theories that is there, and this class of theories is compatible with doubly general relativity, and the possibility that has not been explored in detail, but that is there, is that this effective field theory for general relativity and doubly general relativity, that these two theory spaces do not coincide. I mean, if you do the simplest thing, and you just impose, and you look at general relativity in the space-time formulation, then you should write down all low-dimensional curvature invariants that you can construct from the four metric in your effective action. Whereas here we have very different structural constraints on the effective action, and they may be distinguishable from GR once you go beyond Einstein-Hilbert. Of course, for the Einstein-Hilbert action, the two frameworks coincide, but once you go beyond that, once you look at effects that are not yet observed, but that could be observable in a semi-classical regime, then you can distinguish these two theory spaces from one another, and you could possibly falsify this doubly general relativity scenario through such observations. So this is one possibility that I wanted to talk about. The next thing, slide number 20, is that is that we shaped some, that we have some view on dualities with that. So if you remember, those of you who remember my last talk on shape dynamics, I had a quick presentation of a white boundary duality that occurs very naturally in shape dynamics. And that is at large, and that is the usual, the Hamiltonian of usual shape dynamics, where we don't trade all the scalar constraints of ADM, but where we leave one, where we retain one leftover scalar constraint. That becomes in a large volume regime just a constraint on the a leftover conformal constraint, precisely in this form of trace pi squared minus 12 lambda has to vanish. So that becomes dynamically the one conformal constraint that we have not traded for. So now the gauge group has a spatial diffeomorphisms and volume preserving conformal transformations, and then we have also the the dynamics turns into this volume changing conformal transformation. So at large CMC volume, so in the infinite volume limit, this is why we call it by boundary, you have a classical completely conformal field theory at very large volume when the volume dominates over all other degrees of freedom. So now in doubly general relativity, we have a generator of evolution, this BST gauge fix generator. So this is why I would call it a bulk Hamiltonian. And it is, and this bulk Hamiltonian is now, can now be viewed as the gauge fixing of two different theories. It could be viewed either as a gauge fixing of ADM or as a gauge fixing of shape dynamics. So this is where we have a bulk duality. And this is also a scenario that is not explored in detail of what it does. I mean, what I can tell you is we know that this is how this implies the relation of the observables of the two theories. But we haven't explored it in any particular context, how you're able to translate predictions from one theory into predictions from the other theory and vice versa. But I want to remark that this symmetry trading and symmetry adapting mechanism is very generic. And then, I mean, you saw that I just do some formal manipulations and I follow these same structural ideas. And that could possibly be an explanation for a large class of dualities, including those white boundary dualities of type ADS-CFT. But really doing something explicitly in that is not, we haven't started doing that explicitly, except for this one thing where we explored the large CMC volume limit of usual shape dynamics. So let's go to slide number 21, and this is an immediate question you would have if you're interested in the renormalization of quantum gravity, because now I have additional structural constraints on the effective action, so can I say something about counterterms? Can I find additional constraints in counterterms? And I mean, possibly the answer is yes, but it seems unfeasible in the metric formulation precisely due to the nonlinearity of the BIS transformations that I've been that I've pointed out in previous slides. So right now we do not have a clear idea whether that can help anything with any with perturbative renormalization. However, there are of course ideas. I mean, you can ask the obvious questions out, obvious questions for ways out. One is. Is there a formulation of doubly general relativity where enough of the transformations are linearly realized? Because then they, then you don't have, then the Legendre transform of the field expectation value is just the field itself. So you would translate the linearly realized transformations directly as constraints on the effective action. And that would make predictions about possible counterterms very feasible. Because you could just, because they're essentially, they're just classical structural constraints on the effective action then. And the other thing is a more provocative idea, that is that we may find that we may want to use a different gauge fixing for that would improve power counting in some way. The idea behind that is that the partition function is independent of the gauge fixing, provided you have a solution to the quantum mass equation. I mean, there are technical requirements for that to happen. But essentially, you say the partition function is in, does not depend on the particular gauge fixing function that you have. So now if you view the partition function as a partition function for this extended shape dynamic system, then you can put in a different gauge fixing, something that is not ADM. And this could improve power, counting, but we have not found anything that does that quite yet. And also, what I have to warn you at this point is, even if you found that, you would then have a partition function that would be interpreted as a partition function of extended shape dynamics. We know how to relate, and you would calculate expectation values of observables for extended shape dynamics with that, from that partition function. But you would have then to translate these expectation values into expectation values for ADM, so reinterpreting what you have just calculated. So there is, this is why I call this a more provocative idea. So let me come to the conclusion, slide number 22. So what I hope I conferred in this talk is that the symmetry trading that we use to construct shape dynamics is a very generic mechanism that you can, and in particular the linking theory formalism, it's a very generic thing that you can use to construct equivalent gauge theories. And now this symmetry trading formalism implies in particular that you have this particular version of what we call symmetry doubling in the BST formalism, namely that the effect, that the gauge fixed action has two invariances. And that mechanism is also rather generic. Now, if you put these two technical observations together, then the equivalence of shape dynamics and general relativity gives you this preferred action that we call doubly general relativity. And once you have constructed this action, then you get immediately a new theory space for gravity, because these are new structure constraints you would put on a gravity action. And I just explored the first immediate couple of questions here, and this is could you experimentally falsify? What are the semi-classical predictions once you put in these new structure constraints? Could you experimentally falsify that once you go beyond Einstein-Hilbert, of course? Then something that I didn't talk about very much in this talk that I used as a motivation was, could this revised theory space, putting these additional structural constraints on the effective action, have anything, explain anything in the exact renormalization group framework, and in particular, could it explain a new universality class in that framework? And also what I alluded to in the second to last slide was that we have a new view on dualities, these five dualities in our case now. And the last point that I want to remark, just quickly remark, is that we just started thinking about using this framework, this W general relativity framework, to do quantum cosmology. And basically, what put in the idea of this W general relativity, that there is the hidden invariance in the shape dynamics, actually do this in quantum cosmology, because now we have a reason to modify the relativity equation to be adapted to this to these structural constraints, and this is essentially what you're more familiar with is in loop quantum cosmology. You modify the relativity equation there, you get some new effects, and if you wouldn't have loop quantum gravity as a reason why this is well motivated, why these changes are well motivated, you would just say, okay, you get out what you put in. But with the whole story that there is loop quantum gravity that motivates this model, you have a good reason to modify the relativity equation in this particular way. And you can say, okay, these are predictions of a theory that models this particular feature of full loop quantum gravity. And in the same sense is what we are starting to think about doing cosmology in this framework. So let's go to the last slide. I want to thank you for your attention, and I also want to point out my thanks to my collaborators that are listed on this slide.
Questions? Questions?
Okay, I'll try one. Tim, do you have a reason? You mentioned that you think that the story of the counterterms and the curvature squared counterterms is going to be different. But I'm confused about that. Do you have a reason? Because there seems to be a kind of contradiction between, you start off by saying that the symmetry trading mechanism is very general, and then you end up pointing to it being very specific. Do you have a reason to believe that the symmetry trading will not be possible once you go past the Einstein-Hilbert action and add higher derivative terms, curvature squared terms?
I have a practical reason for that, not anything that is really theoretical, well motivated. Practical thing is I tried to find terms that satisfy that satisfy these structural constraints, and I couldn't find them. So failing to find them says, okay, they may not be there, but I don't have a proof that there aren't any local terms that satisfy these structural constraints. All I know is that it's different from including, for example, R squared terms.
So for R scalar squared terms, which don't change the phase space appreciably, you can extend the shape dynamics gauge fixing to a set of first class constraints?
I have tried that and I failed with doing that. So the answer right now is I don't know.
But R squared terms do change the phase space because they add a scalar graviton, basically.
So this is near yes.
Yeah, I was just commenting that adding R squared
adds a
new degree of freedom, so it does change the phase space.
I mean, for me, I have a more elementary view on that, and that is once you add higher derivative once you have first derivative squared, essentially, you have you add new degrees of freedom because you have new initial conditions for this theory. Very much in the way that the poltergeist appeared in the higher derivatives, in the fourth order gravity that was very popular in the 1980s.
Good. Okay. Okay, thank you.
More questions?
This is Niyash Shapiai. So is there any reason to believe that at low energy this theory should be exactly the same as GR, or is it just a construction that is GR? Couldn't you add, for Java gravity, do you have relevant deformations of GR at low energies?
I tried to add the first term that you would add in Schaber gravity would be this deformation on trace pi, but on the refoliation constraints, and that term makes this system second class. So you cannot impose this structural constraint that you have two invariances, one under refoliation and one under spatial conformal transformation. So that's where it doesn't work. Actually, what used to be an embarrassment for this Machian framework was that you could always have this possibility, but observations are hinting to a very high accuracy now, thanks to Niyash, we're talking about the Ridge supermetric here, and there is this one free parameter between basically pi dot pi, the trace of pi dot pi, and the trace of pi squared term, and observations favor that this is that you have the value lambda equals 1, which is the general covariance. And in the usual Machian framework, you could always have this not there. You could have this parameter take an arbitrary value. Now, if you impose these new structure constraints, it has to be 1. That's one of the new things that we know through this.
Other questions?
I'll try another one. If symmetry trading is general, then it should exist also for the Ashtakar variables or for the Plobansky phase space. Have you tried to find whether shape dynamics exists in that formulation?
There is a formulation of shape dynamics in pure Ashtakar variables, and for pure gravity in Ashtakar variables. However, the nice feature about the conformal constraints is that they're very simple in metric variables, whereas if you express them in terms of Ashtakar variables, they become very complicated. And the thing is basically, you have the conformal constraints are k dot e. And now if you express k, the extrinsic curvature form, in Ashtakar variables, it's complicated because you have to take the difference of the Ashtakar connection and the spin connection. And the spin connection is something that is a nonlinear function of the momenta, which is the densitized inverse triad fields. So yes, there exists a version of shape dynamics in Ashtakar variables, but it is but precisely formulating it makes introduces something that is very that is not very appealing. Yet you can use it, and you can, if you're doing some, you can do some tentative things with that. But it doesn't look very nice and natural what you have to do with that. A different thing is if you use a tetrad or a triad variable. So the usual again formulation extended to that you would use for when you, for example, include spinners. And in that formulation, the Gauss constraint of Ashtekar is just the internal rotation constraint or the partial gauge fixing of the internal Lorentz transformations. And that thing, and in those variables, in that formulation, it takes a very simple, the conformal constraints take a very simple form. Again, it's just a trace of the momentum conjugate to the triad fields or the tetrad fields. And that is a nice system, but then you don't have the loop quantization available for that system.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Jim again.